Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
And keep your dial right where it is at 99.5 FM. We'll try that again. Natural Living with Gary Null. Please stay tuned.
Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Served various positions in the U.S. Army, including the 101st Airborne Division, Staff Sergeant, and Public Affairs Officer. He has also served as a panel member of the Center for Disease Control Conference on Gulf War Illness and has provided written and verbal testimony with regard to the Gulf War illnesses issues in congressional, senatorial, and presidential hearings. Nice to have you with us today again, Vic.
Good morning, sir.
To your knowledge, what percentage of Gulf War vets have symptoms of Gulf War syndrome?
Well, in 1996, just prior to the VA discontinuing their public releases of demographic information on Gulf War vets, their report stated that they were working with 250,000 Gulf War veteran claims and were paying some 6,000 death benefits. Now, based on our information, we started taking survey information in 1991, right after the war was over, and we had our first sick veterans coming back. Our first sick vet came back in August of 1991. During 1991 through 1995, we received 10,051 calls, and we did surveys on each of those. Out of those calls, 4,611 calls or surveys were verified, okay, which reflects some 45.87% of the total calls received. Calls from active duty personnel were not verifiable due to military policies. However, we were able to verify the veterans by calling on their medical entities, providing the treatment, or by examination of hand-carried medical records to show that treatment had been received.
Mm-hmm. So what would you put your number at?
Right now, I would put my number at both veterans registered with the VA and veterans pursuing private entities at the in the region of 300,000.
So almost 50%, getting approaching 50%.
That's correct.
Are you aware of any other conflict, any other American war statistics from the Civil War, the Revolutionary War, Vietnam, Korea, where you had that high percentage of vets who are suffering from post-illnesses after the war?
No, I'm not. A lot of people will reflect on World War II in regards to those claims, but we have to remember that there was a large amount of combat during that time, and the majority of those claims for the World War II Korean War veterans were based on combat injury, i.e. they've been shot, blown up, physical injuries pertaining to their activities at that time. But I'm not aware of anything on this scale in the history And the history of the United States on chemical and biological warfare exposure, of course, goes all the way back to the Revolutionary War.
From what country did the chemicals the Gulf War soldiers were exposed to originate?
Well, there's Iraq purchased materials from numerous countries. However, we did have a number of United States companies that were cited and during the Gulf War for violation of the U.S. embargo and sending materials to Saddam. With those folks of us who were back here watching the TV while our young folks were fighting the war, observed the FBI going into the offices, seizing the materials, and a large number of these companies were found guilty of violating the U.S. embargo and fined by the U.S. Department of Commerce. However, we also have to understand and realize that we're not just talking chemical warfare here. One of our situations that we have in that the Gulf was the fact that it is in the middle of the oil fields. And those oil fields use the chemicals that are used in everyday production and procurement of crude oil. And when they blew up the oil fields, if people will remember and look at some of the photographs, they will see the little sticks or poles sticking out of the ground. Those were remains of storage sheds that contained the chemicals that are used in the everyday production and procurement of crude oil. Things like benzyl chloride, oxo alcohol, distillation residue, ammonine, disseminine, pyridamine residue. There's all sorts of them there. The interesting point on that being that when Saddam blew up those oil fields, he also blew up those storage sheds. Those chemicals were also in the smoke. Now, in August of 1992, I live in Odessa, Texas, which is the center of the Permian Basin oil fields. In August of 1992, there was a chemical fire of these same chemicals at Champion Chemical in Odessa. That fire burned for 5 hours. They evacuated half the city of Odessa due to those fumes. They did not evacuate our troops out of the Gulf or even out of the smoke residue. So when we look at chemicals, we have to look at the residual chemicals, not only the chemical warfare materials and biological warfare materials, but also the everyday procurement chemicals that were blown up during the course of combat.
10 years after the Gulf War, the general public is still told by reputable news sources that Gulf War syndrome may or may not exist. More often than not, that it does not exist. The latest report says it does not exist. If you occasionally hear from Gulf War vets, and it's only occasional that you ever hear them in the media, and they say they're suffering from Gulf War syndrome, and yet we seem to have very little interest in the mainstream media of scratching the surface of this issue. They seem to go to the official sources, the Pentagon, Defense Department, White House, one of the government oversight committees, VA, who says it's all in their head. And that stops the investigation. It just stops dead in its track. And yet if you talk with the Gulf War vets and their family members, who are appealing to the Defense Department, Department of Veterans Affairs, for their support, you have a different story. Now, you've been confronted with the reality that these agencies are reluctant to admit the Gulf War syndrome exists because that would expose a whole Pandora's box of faults and failures on the part of the military.
Well, I
just want to get it all out.
Okay.
What are some of the tricks of propaganda that the Department of Defense and its supporters have used, and go into great detail on this, because I think it's important the next time someone reads in the New York Times or Washington Post that the latest expert opinion from the Surgeon General, whoever, says Gulf War syndrome does not exist, that there is a whole campaign behind that.
That's correct. I think the being a public affairs specialist and having attended the Defense Information School, which was at Fort Ben Harrison in Indianapolis, of course, I was trained in a little bit of this situation. And the point being that we have had a large amount of our budgets, defense into the defense budgets, allocated, you know, to chemical and biological warfare defense and things like that. And if the truth came out that our troops were unable to be defended because our equipment was not worthwhile, it would really throw the Defense Department budget system into chaos. And I state that, you know, we're talking about the Department of Defense saying, well, you know, we weren't ready, or we didn't know that this was going to happen, or we did our best to protect our troops. And I turn around, and my response to that is, okay, in 1969, 1 year alone, the Department of Defense spent $1,146,000,000 on chemical and biological warfare research. Where is the research? You know, where is the information? This has not only been done, of course, I can always go back to the scientific argument, which yourself, as a scientist, you understand that, you know, I can put two scientists in the room together, and if they are both driving for funding for their particular project, which is their, you know, financial future here for the next few years, that two scientists will stand and argue that white is black and black is white, and we'll give you reasonable arguments for those issues. I'd like to refer back to a 1997 oversight report of the Subcommittee on Human Resources on Government Reform, which states, after 19 months of investigation and hearings, the subcommittee finds the status of efforts on Gulf War issues by the Department of Veterans Affairs and the Department of Defense, the Central Intelligence Agency, and the Food and Drug Administration to be irreparably flawed. We find that these efforts hobbled by institutional inertia, the mistakes, motion for progress. We find these efforts plagued by arrogant incuriosity and a pervasive myopia that sees a lack of evidence as proof. As a result, we find current approaches on research, diagnosis, and treatment unlikely to yield answers to veterans' life or death questions in the foreseeable or even distant future. Now, that's a heck of a deal. And then they go on to say that their findings in brief, that the VA and DOD did not listen to Gulf War veterans as possible causes of reported illness. The presence of a variety of toxic agents in the Gulf theater strongly suggests exposure plays a role in causing, triggering, or amplifying subsequent service-connected illnesses. Gulf War troops were not trained to protect themselves from the effects of exposure to depleted uranium dust and particles. Pyridostigmine bromide can have serious side effects and interactions when taken in combination with other drugs, vaccines, chemical exposures, heat, and or physical exercise. The VA and DOD health registry diagnostic protocols relied on the unfounded conclusions that there were no chemical, biological, or other toxic exposures to the U.S. troops in the Gulf War theater. VA and DOD registry diagnosis protocols continue to be based on unwarranted conclusion that unless there is an immediate and acute reaction, exposures to chemical weapons and other toxins do not cause delayed or chronic symptoms. Premature ruling out of toxic exposures as causative. DOD and VA doctors relied on diagnoses of somatoform disorder and post-traumatic stress disorder to explain Gulf War illness. There is no credible evidence that stress or PTSD causes the illnesses of many Gulf War veterans. And I have the same question. You have a Gulf War veteran who has had diarrhea continuously 4 or 5 days a week for the last 10 years. I don't see that is due to PTSD. They also state that acute diagnosis of veterans' illnesses remain difficult due to inadequate or missing personnel records, missing toxic detection logs, and unreleased classified documents. I have to talk on the same thing. My son, when he was in the port of Al Jabal, was taken to a mailroom tent, walked into the tent, was given a shot in each arm, and told to go on. There was no documentation of what he received. There was no indication of what was made or what he was given on his medical records. you know as well as I do that if you go to a doctor and you're sick, the doctor asks you what you've taken, what you've done. If you can't tell the doctor what you've been exposed to or what you've been given, that delays makes the diagnosis extremely difficult. So I'm hoping that things that we've been working with and continuing to fight on with will slowly break these things down.
The only time will tell on that. Let's continue on with our discussion,
okay,
because I would like for you to give all the people in this audience who couldn't have been in the Gulf War, weren't there, don't know anyone who was, a chance through your eyes and the recollections of all the people, including your own son, to show what it was like, to show how many different things they were exposed to that in combination could have caused, and in many cases did cause, what we are now calling Gulf War Syndrome. Take us on a day through the life of your son or one of these other individuals, all right?
Well, the best day that I can... that I could possibly go with on the one day with the life of my son was when he had called me in the evening and we talked about the activities during the day, and he had been pulling guard duty on the roof of his barracks where he was lodging, and stating that he could not see more than a quarter of a mile from the roof because of the heavy black smoke and the things that were coming through. The air quality was extremely poor. It was extremely hot. There was very, very little wind. And he had a hard time breathing during the day because of the oppressive heat. And he was just watching these black clouds of smoke just rolling around all over the place. He also didn't understand why at the end of his shift he had to go downstairs and strip off all of his outer gear down to T-shirt and pants and a pair of boots, and they had to go run 4 or 5 miles. What he didn't understand was that they had not been issued their camouflage T-shirts, etc. They were all wearing white T-shirts, and here they are running around the outside of the compound in white T-shirts in a combat zone. He thought that was very strange. He then went on to work, and of course they went to the situation there with the mailroom, and we at that time were receiving calls from veterans' wives who were talking about their husbands having what they called the sordid crud, the flu, what they felt was the flu. They were having runny eyes, runny nose, respiratory problems, hacking and coughing, et cetera, and so forth. So we were receiving that information. And during the course of that conflict, and this was on the night of January 19th, during the course of that conversation, I heard a massive explosion on the phone. And next thing I got was the phone banging against the wall. After a couple of minutes, my son came back on the phone, breathing heavily, and I asked him, "Are you doing okay?" And I said, "What the hell was that?" Excuse my language. And he said, "I don't know, something just exploded over the port here." I said, "Well, are you okay?" He said, "Yeah, I'm okay, but Adcock's going to have to go back to the barracks and change his pants." The key issue on this point is that in 1993, I was at a hearing conducted by Lane Evans and Joe Kennedy, and I heard a young lady by the name of Hester Adcock testifying on the panel before I was, talking about her son standing there on the port of Aljubal, talking to her and the explosion, and her getting the phone banging against the wall and her son coming back and answering the positive answer when she asked him if he was okay. "Yeah, I'm okay," but his statement was that Sylvester will have to go change his pants. He done messed him. The issue on this point is that Michael Adcock died from numerous unknown, undiagnosed cancers 11 months after he returned from the Persian Gulf. He was standing 30 feet away from my son. What we did during the Gulf War, the Operation Desert Shield Desert Storm Association was formed as the Operation Desert Shield Association in November 1990. It was formed because the young men, when I went to Fort Eustis, Virginia, I asked my son and the young men and women in his unit, what did they want us to do for them while they were in the Gulf fighting our war? Three out of four of those young men and women had somebody either in their family circle or their friendship circle who was involved in the Agent Orange problem and fighting the VA and DOD for benefits. They felt that the major problem behind that issue was the fact that during the Vietnam War, nobody kept any documentation except the government. And, of course, when the veterans came back trying to get their claims and trying to get supportive documentation, the government classified it all. So their request to us was to keep the documents, document the war, which is what I did. I came back to Odessa. We had 120 families here with people in the Gulf. We created the Operation Desert Shield Association, and we started recording everything that came across the TVs, going to the Texas Tech Health Science Center libraries, and any time that there was an issue in regards of illness, disease, chemicals, anything like that, we go down, research it, document it, and then keep those documents. And we've been doing that ever since. So I hope that that's helped do your question, answer your question a little bit. The,
yeah, that gives
90%
me a lot
of the Department of Defense will dance based on classified, what they call classified information.
Yes.
Which is the best excuse you can that you can put up that information is classified national security, or you turn around and you turn it against the people who are making the complaints, which is what happened to the Gulf War veterans. You know, the Department of Defense under the leadership of Dick Cheney, when the Gulf War issue first came out, our folks from Indiana, there was 130 of those folks that were all sick. People started talking about those issues. They were first called malingerers. You know, people that were bums, were looking for handouts, et cetera, and so forth. That was what was coming out of the Department of Defense. You know, unfortunately, we had a lot of people who were labeled with that situation, not just junior enlisted personnel. We had medical personnel. We had nurses. We had professional military personnel, colonels, all the way up to generals. General Franks got sick. All of these people were bad-mouthed, and the negative publicity on these issues are what the Department of Defense used against the Gulf War veterans to try to tone this down. Because if you remember rightly, if your people will think back to January 14th, 1991, prior to the start of the war, Dr. Raymond Bonnebue from the Department of Veterans Affairs, when they were talking about the high list, high possibility of casualties and everything else, and right after Saddam had spoken about using chemical and biological warfare materials, his statement was that the VA had been training for 5 months and that they were ready. They designated San Antonio and Dallas VAs to receive and treat chemical and biological warfare casualties. Now, they're the ones that told us they were ready, not us. And here we are 10 years later, and we still have people with undiagnosed illnesses, and we still have people who are not receiving treatment.
Vic, let's take a look at the consequences. The consequences of not addressing this issue to the vets, go through the different conditions that you've seen that are now unique to this. In other words, we couldn't write it off as being something that has happened before to masses of people. But this is something, these conditions are not general conditions the average person is going to face in their lifetime.
Well, what we have in here, based on our observations, you have people that suffering from chronic fatigue, okay? 90% of the people in our surveys suffer from chronic fatigue. We have people that have continuous headaches. That was how I first understood that there was something wrong with my son. My son's room was next to us, and we kept hearing this banging banging, banging, and I went in, and he was on his knees in the middle of a darkened room, banging his head against the floor. We have people whose eyes are extremely sensitive to bright light. They have rashes and water blisters that come up. My son has the same thing. For some unknown reason, he'll get water blisters all over his feet. They'll stay for 3 or 4 weeks and then leave. He loses vision. His vision becomes blurred for no apparent reason. It'll come and go. They suffer from bleeding gums, aching joints, rectal bleeding. One of the things I'd mentioned before was the constant diarrhea. When you have a veteran who has diarrhea 5-6 times a week and has had that consistently for the last 8 years, that's not in his head. We have people with blood in their urine, blood in their stool. 95% of our sick vets have sleep problems. They have lumps that come up under their skin that do not break the surface. A lot of them have abdominal pains in the lower right quadrant. They have skin changes in texture and color. 91% of them are suffering from short-term memory loss. 93% of them are suffering from mood swings out of normal ranges, and that was one of the first calls that we received, first line of calls that we received early late in 1991 and early in 1992. Wives and mothers and girlfriends would be calling us and saying, what happened to our troops? We sent a teddy bear to the Gulf, and we got a grizzly bear back. And they have been constant. There's an extremely high rate of divorces and separations with the Gulf War community due to the fact that the veterans have become extremely explosive. And, the slightest thing turns them off. Some of them have become violent. We've got a number of them in jail because of violent explosions. And unfortunately, in some cases, they don't even realize that they've done it. So we have that type of situation. We have unexplained weight loss. We have our weight swings. My son does the same thing, where he'll go for a while and just balloon. And then he'll come back, and all of a sudden, for no apparent reason, and he doesn't change his diet, his weight will drop 20 or 30 pounds. Sleeplessness. He walks up and down half the night, being unable to sleep. He stops breathing in his sleep. All of these things, we're talking about a young man who was the top of his physical condition, was County Student of the Year, received a Gulf Watch for that, was captain of a rifle team, was known for his mental capability of being able to figure out rifle scores without the use of calculators, could do that faster than what his coach could with a calculator. Who now has an extremely hard time balancing a checkbook and keeping appointments. And he doesn't know from one day to the next, and the same with the other Gulf War vets. They don't know from one day to the next whether they're going to be able to get out of bed the next morning. So I hope that helped a little bit.
Sure does, Vic. I appreciate these input. There's a lot of good information. Just one last, or maybe two last questions. Throughout your work, you've stressed the importance of the Department of Defense honoring the contract between the military and the veterans. What exactly does the contract stipulate?
Well, my comments on the honor of the contract was based on the fact that when the recruiter came to my house and sat down and presented his program, he, as an official representative of the United States government, made an implied contract, and we signed a contract afterwards, that if my son got hurt, sick, wounded, or injured in the service of his country, they would take care of him. Now, U.S. versus Klein, 80, U.S. 122, 13 Wall, 128 LED, and there's a whole line of them, a contract of enlistment is based on an obligation of mutual faithfulness, and it is as much the duty of the government as individuals to fulfill its obligations. An official representative of the United States government sat on my couch, and for me to sign for my son, because he was underage, He stated that if my son got hurt, sick, wounded, or injured in the service of his country, they would take care of him. They did not state that he had to get shot with a right-handed bullet with a left-handed screw in the middle of the left buttock. They did not designate that. They said if he got hurt, sick, wounded, or injured, they'd take care of him. And this whole Gulf War issue, if the United States government and the United States Department of Defense would take care of their contract and take care of our troops, we wouldn't have the Gulf War on us situation, because our troops would be treated, our veterans would be taken care of, and their families would be taken care of.
I understand what you say. Makes sense.
It's just a simple matter. It's not whether they were exposed to chemical warfare, biological warfare, DU radiation, or whatever it was. The simple matter of the fact is that when they signed up our troops in an all-volunteer army, if you go to Sears and you buy a washing machine and that washing machine salesman tells you that it will take 30 pounds of wash and it will dry in 10 minutes, you buy the machine, you get it home, and it only takes 10 pounds of wash and it takes 30 minutes and you haven't even got the thing dry yet, you're going to go back to that salesman and say, you messed me over, correct the situation. With the all-volunteer army, the United States Department of Defense authorized representative came to the veteran's house or met with the veteran wherever he was at, enlisted him under an implied contract and implied benefits. That veteran accepted those, went, did his service to this nation, completed his side of the project, just like you do when you pay the cash for the washing machine. When he got home, the washing machine didn't work. We have laws that make companies take care of their business when they sell or when they provide incorrect services. We can take them to court. We can do all of that. A veteran can't do that under the Ferris Doctrine. What we have is a failure to honor a contract. The leader at that time was Dick Cheney as the Secretary of Defense. He had the power to honor the contract by signing for it. It was made in his name as Secretary of Defense.
But what could he have lost? Always look at motive. What could he have lost by doing that? What would our government
The fact that millions of dollars have been spent through the defense industry contracts, etc., and so forth. And remember, we had a chemical suit manufacturer that sent chemical suits that did not meet specs and leaked to our troops in the Gulf. You have millions and millions of dollars that were spent in the chemical biological warfare programs through the Department of Defense, through the defense industry conglomerates. And if it was proved that their activities did not work, and it was proved in those situations where the stuff that we provided were not available, we knew that our protective gear was not going to save us from it, then that would destroy. And Dick Cheney said himself to the Sortie Prince, and it's in one of the reports, that if the Department of Defense messed this up, the military was ruined in the United States. And it will be. One of the points that I'd like to make before we get finished here is where is our major concern? Our major concern is that in addition to the chemical and biological warfare materials that our troops are exposed to, we have endemic diseases to that area, i.e. leishmaniasis, schistosomiasis, Wintera bancrofti. Those diseases can remain dormant, and they are documented. Leishmaniasis has been documented since 1892, and the DOD knows it. These diseases can remain dormant in the body for up to 20 years. We have to have the capability for the veteran to be able to receive testing and treatment for that 20-year period. And I'll leave you with one more question. Nobody has answered me yet from DOD or the scientific community. If you have a dormant gene in your body from a disease, when you have a child or you have sexual intercourse with your loved one, and you pass on your genes, are you passing that disease on? And are we looking at disease in this country 20 years from now?
Well, if it's the case that it could be infectious, and from what I understand, many of the conditions Gulf War vets are suffering from have infected their family members.
That's what we have reports on, yes.
Then, exponentially, those family members coming into contact, casual contact or sexual contact with other members of the population could cause millions and millions of people to be infected.
That's
who
correct.
Then could cause other millions of people to be infected, because we have no idea what will happen to a genetically modified virus or bacteria in a person's system when they're already under siege with their immune competence from all the environmental factors we currently are adversely affected by.
Right. Well, when back in 1994, we had a major effort and we were successful for a little bit on restricting veterans from giving blood because of the possibility of infection from these things. It was Congress passed a 2-year moratorium on veterans passing blood. One of the big things on that, my wife passed away a couple of 3 years ago with from cancer. But while we were in Dallas, we were going through the bone marrow transplant situation and the blood deals. And of course, she was using a tremendous amount of blood. I went to the hospital blood bank and met a couple of the veterans that I knew, Gulf War veterans, who were there donating blood because they were being paid for it. And I went off the wall on it because I asked the director of the blood bank, are you going to give that blood? With these guys, we now have no idea what they've got in their blood. To my wife, who is going through chemotherapy and bone marrow transplant, and to other patients in this hospital. And now you got to remember, this hospital is 10 blocks away from the VA. And she said, "Well, I didn't know anything about the problems." And I said, you didn't know that there was a moratorium on veterans doing blood and all that? No, nobody ever notified us.
Hmm.
So,
because that blood is pooled.
Well, what happened was that there was a 2-year moratorium on it. After 14 months, the Red Cross and Miss Elizabeth Dole went back before Congress to get it lifted because they were running out of blood. 1/3 of the blood supply for this country is supplied by the veterans and the active duty personnel. And
so we could be infecting.
One of the things that a homeless vet does when he becomes homeless, one of the first things he does is go down and sell his blood every month.
Well, he could be putting Mycoplasma incognitus right into the blood supply if they're selling blood.
That's correct. And my concern, of course, is that we have no idea what the genetic, as you've talked about, the genetic genes and all that have been trained around, on these what they call investigational products, which we call experimental. We have no idea what the long-term effects of that is going to be. Everybody knows basically that things like multiple sclerosis, spinal bifida, CS, all that type of stuff, often shows up in second and third generation. And that's one of my major concerns for the Gulf War families, is what are we looking at 20 years from now when the children who are being born to current Gulf War veterans grow up and have their own children? Are we going to look at a massive birth defect situations? And I know it's like Peter and the Wolf. However, we have to be concerned about that.
Well, we're not even concerned about the Gulf War vets. You can't imagine the indifference is going to be occurring to their grandchildren.
That's correct.
And their children. So these are issues that the American public, unfortunately, is not fully aware of, but must be made aware of. And that's why we're doing these programs. And sometimes people won't get the message first, second, or third time. Even I was speaking with a person. I was on an airplane recently, and ma'am was looking at the manuscript I was writing. I was writing a script, shooting script for my new Gulf War Syndrome, Deadly Legacy. We're reshooting the whole thing all over again because there's so much new information. And it was interesting. We were talking about what the public will and will not accept. And this man's in the television business. He said, we do infomercials. And his company, and he said, it sometimes takes 12 times for someone to see an entire infomercial before they finally pick up a phone and do something. Unfortunately, in the context of our rapid media exposures to issues and then quickly dropping, going on to the next issue, we don't give time to really lay out a story, go over it again, look at all of its details, see its relevance, connect the dots to our own lives. So most people get what is nothing more than a headline news understanding of the world in which we live, including Gulf War Syndrome. They'll hear, well, the Surgeon General said that Gulf War Syndrome is really just a all-in-your-mind phenomena, and therefore people just go on with the next story. So we have to remind ourselves the importance of this. And Vic, I want to thank what you're doing and the members of your groups and the other groups out there to keep the message alive, because I'm sure that every vet who's suffering in their family would only wish that the major media would pick up on this message and be consistent in carrying it forward, so we could cause a groundswell of public support and get families calling their legislators to hold Watergate-like hearings where people are sworn under oath, where Schwarzkopf's put under oath, Colin Powell under oath, and ask questions that they can be held responsible for the answers.
That's correct. If I may make one last comment. Many people are under the misunderstanding that because you are a veteran, the VA will take care of you. Yes, there are a large number of veterans who are being taken care of by the VA. However, for every veteran that receives care from the VA, there is at least a dozen who are fighting every day. The VA does not take care of all veterans. The VA takes care of the veterans that they have to take care of because, based on documentation and legal requirement, they can't get out of it.
All right. Well, I'm sure most people didn't know that. Vic Sylvester, thank you very much for being on. We'll look forward to making arrangements, to film you in our new documentary. And that's going to be happening in the next month. So all the best to you and your efforts.
Thank you, sir. And for every Gulf War veteran and every veteran who may be listening out there, thank you for your service to this nation. Some of us are proud of you.
Absolutely. Let's go over now and say hello to our next panelist. She is Colonel Melinda LeDuc, L-U-D-U-C. She was a career U.S. Army Reserve nurse. She has spent 29 years in the active and reserve Army Nurse Corps. In September 1990, she answered a call from the Pentagon soliciting her services and for Desert Shield assignment. She reported and served as chief nurse operating room with the stipulation that if her neurosurgical detachment was activated, she would be free to join them. In December 1990, she accompanied the unit to Saudi Arabia, better known as Scud City. In 1994, she was sent to Walter Reed Army Medical Center, Washington, D.C. She remained there until her retirement in April of 1996. She was diagnosed with lung cancer shortly after the Gulf War and believes it is directly related to her involvement in Gulf War. Nice to have you with us today. Melina?
Hello.
How are you?
I'm fine.
Good. I hear something in the background. Do you have a radio or television or anything on?
No, just me. And one of my dogs is near me. You might hear the dog puffing. We don't have much time to talk.
That's right. We still have plenty of time to get into the issues.
Oh, all right.
How was your health before the Gulf War compared to after the Gulf War?
Excellent. I'm a little older than most of the guys. I was a little older than most of the people in my unit, so I was also very vain. So I would do my PT with the younger group and max it as often as possible, so that it would not reveal my true age. So I didn't go with the older ones for the PT. I was always very proud of the fact that I could that I was very agile and in excellent physical condition. And just before I went to the Gulf, I had a chest X-ray, which was normal, and it was a routine chest X-ray. While I was in the Gulf, I developed pneumonia, and where I was, we were bombed night and day. That's why it was called Scud City. And They keep saying there was nothing in those bombs, but please don't believe that, because there were many, many symptoms we had that were very suggestive that there was more than just plain bombs that were being shattered in the sky over us. The Patriots would shatter those scuds, but what was in them would filter down to the earth, and that's when we would have running noses and runny eyes and diarrhea and all kinds of other things that I won't discuss over the television, over the radio. And so anyway, then I also developed asthma, real bad asthma, bronchial asthma, they said, and asthmatic bronchitis. And when I came back, I was reassigned to active duty to Fort Benning. And while I was there, about in March of 92, they took some more x-rays, and they said, oh, by the way, they took an x-ray in the Gulf when I had that pneumonia, and they showed a little tiny scar, which was a pneumonia scar. But the following year, in March of 92, when they took another x-ray, that little scar looked a little bit bigger. So they kept saying that was just scar tissue from the pneumonia, and that I should go back to my reserve unit, and I was fine. There was nothing wrong. But anyway, I insisted. I said I wasn't born with it, and I didn't have it before I went to the Gulf, and I want to know what it is, so please open it up and take a biopsy. And so they were very insulting everywhere I went, and they tried to falsify records of mine and all kinds of horrible, horrible things.
How did they do that? How did they falsify?
Well,
records?
They tried to say there was nothing wrong with me, and the CT scan that was taken at the Eisenhower Army Hospital, they I guess they got the X-ray the radiologist to write a little differently from what he actually saw to make it look like there was nothing wrong, and they ridiculed me and insulted me like you wouldn't believe. They did Chief of Pulmonology at Eisenhower would stand in the doorway and give me a doorway diagnosis that there was nothing wrong. It was all in my head. So I kept insisting. So finally they sent me to Walter Reed, where, thank God, someone said, well, let's see what's going on. She does look like a little scar, but let's open it up and find out. And that's when they found out I had two primary lesions in my right lung, and so most of my right lung has been removed. Meanwhile, my other friends, many of my other friends who had the same problem and the same scar in their lungs, they were also told it's nothing, it's just scar from the pneumonia you had while you were in the Gulf, and
Melina,
go home and do your business. They're all now dead. And
how many of them are dead?
Well, I had eight friends who had the similar diagnosis that I had, that it was just a scar. And they had developed asthma, too, while they were there. And they're all, the last one just died last Christmas from cancer of the lung. And I thank God in heaven that I am still alive.
How old
were
they?
And they said I'm cured because they were able to get it out of my body early enough that it did not spread.
How old were these eight other people who died of lung cancer?
They were much younger than me. There was one who was 26 years old. Well, they ranged from about 26 to 50.
That's still very young.
Yes.
Were any of them non-smokers?
One was a smoker.
So,
but
you,
the rest were non-smokers.
What is the?
Because I never associated with smoking people.
Okay. Well, here's what we have to ask ourselves: what is the probability that nine people in the same group?
They weren't in the same place I was. They were part of, we networked before
still,
the war and after the, during the war,
okay,
and after the war. They weren't all from my same,
okay,
group. They weren't in my unit.
But still, how rare is it for nine non-smokers who are young to die of lung cancer? That is very
next
unusual.
Next to impossible.
Very unusual.
Next
You're a nurse,
to
you know that.
So, anyway, I developed a whole lot of other problems, too, which when I came out of active duty in 96, While I was on active duty, there were other serious things that happened. I was diagnosed with avascular necrosis of both hips, and the orthopedic doctor kept refusing to do anything, and I was in horrible pain. I was crippled. I was in crutches for a couple of years, several years, and he wouldn't do anything. He kept saying, "There's nothing. It's avascular necrosis. So what?" You know, and the pain was horrific. So finally, that's why I retired in 96. So 3 days afterwards, I had my hip, my worst hip, operated on. I have an artificial hip on that side. And I had to have a knee replacement. And they had, I'm telling you all my problems now. I had a very serious other situation happen since I've been out. And I'm sure it's related to the Gulf War. I developed an arachnoid cyst of my spine from S2 to L3, which had me nearly paralyzed from the waist down. And that has given me a lot of residual problems. Now, that's only the top of the iceberg. There's a lot more. But I will say that when I came out of the service, and now I started working on getting some kind of VA compensation. And so I went to the VA hospital in Gainesville. And the minute they saw the Gulf War written on my forehead, so, you know, GW on my forehead, they treated me like I was a phony and so forth and so on. And I still have not heard from the Veterans Administration what they have evaluated me. I want to add, too, that I've also had to have my right wrist fused and my left wrist partially fused because of traumas that while I was in the Gulf as well. So from a person who is in excellent health and very proud of it, and I guess maybe I didn't appreciate it as much as I would have now if I had it back, to my problems that I have now. I'm not able to walk across the room without getting out of breath. And I thank God that Walter Reed Army Medical Center is continuing my follow-up treatments. And
Who pays for that?
What's that?
Who pays for your treatment?
Well, since I'm retired, I'm allowed to have that. And besides, I was retired with disability. But the VA system, forget about it. You know, they were very cruel. And when I had to have that emergency surgery in my back, I was supposed to have an appointment at the VA hospital, and my husband called them and told them the whole situation. When I was better and went to continue the evaluation for my disability pension, I found a letter in my records saying that these Gulf War phonies are want us to drop everything and take care of them, and they don't feel like making an appointment. They don't even bother to cancel. And I did. My husband did. I was in the operating room when that appointment was supposed to be. And that's an example of what it's like in the VA system. I don't know about all VA hospitals, but there are some that are totally, not ignorant, but totally uncaring about the Gulf War people. They think all of us are lumped in one bunch. They think we're all phonies and that we don't deserve anything and don't deserve even to be treated hardly.
What do you see as behind this? Why wouldn't the government come forward and acknowledge that you have legitimate concerns and to jump in there to help?
I wish I knew. And I wish they stopped wasting money trying to deny there was anything wrong and use that money to find ways to help us to stop this progression of deterioration of the bodies, like with myself, you know? And I'm sure there's a lot of people a lot worse than even I am who are being ignored completely and being shunned by the VA system. You know, I wish I knew. I wish I knew who is behind in the Pentagon that is saying, oh, we've got to prove that there was nothing there, this is all in their minds. You know?
Did you ever believe that a government could be so indifferent or so callous?
Never, never, never. I still feel that it's the people. I'm very proud of my country. And if I had to go again, I would be more than willing. But there are some people in the Pentagon, apparently must be there, I have no idea where else, that are refusing to acknowledge that definitely we have serious problems as a result of what we were exposed to in the Gulf War. And I'm sure as heck that the Iraq was known to be playing with the different bacterias and changing the DNAs and combining things. I'm not much of a scientist, but I read about this. I'm sure that this is what they did, and what we found in the remnants of those bombs that was in those bombs surely should tell them, hey, definitely they had bombs hit over them. Maybe it didn't hit their where they were, except one time that place was less than a mile away from where I was in Dahran that was bombed, and all those kids got killed. The bomb struck one of the buildings. It didn't have to strike a building to do damage to us, you know? And why are they wasting all that money to try to prove there was nothing wrong with us? Why don't they use that money to do research, to acknowledge research, and to follow up on research and to help us, you know? Treat the problem, not try to cover it up.
Very reasonable. I appreciate you being on. I realize that you're in pain and that you're also very frustrated. And
yes.
And the only way we can change is if we have a forum for people to express their experiences.
Well, I sure appreciate you having called me.
Well, we will continue. We've done over 60 programs in Gulf War Vets. We will continue to do more.
Oh, I appreciate it very much. And God bless you, Mr. Null.
Thank you.
And don't give up. Please, please help us.
We're going to do everything we can. I have a documentary I'm doing. We're going to have a press conference. We're going to have a march on Washington in the Pentagon to demonstrate our concern. All that's coming up in the next 4 or 5 months. I'm Gary Knoll. Looking at the clock, we're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. If you'd like a tape of today's show, call 888-317-2346, program number 2745. Have a nice day.